Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome to Exploring the Lord of the Rings. This is session number 116. Good to be back with you here again tonight. We should be getting right up to the beginning of the poem. This is the A. Arendel as a Mariner poem, Bilbo's magnum opus, poetically speaking. The Road Goes Ever On is Bilbo's signature poem. But I think clearly the A. Arendel Was a Mariner poem is his greatest poem, and certainly one of my very favorites. And fair warning, since we're already completely, hopelessly, ludicrously indulgent in this chapter, as if I'm counting correctly, tonight's class is the 23rd class that we are doing in many meetings. Very many meetings indeed, apparently. But anyway, you might as well get hanged for sheep as a lamb. We're going to talk our when we get to the poem, what the plan is going to be. We're going to talk our way through the poem, reading it as is, thinking of it as Bilbo's poem there, and thinking about how that poem works. And then I'm going to go back, kind of like I did with the Uthian poem. Earlier on, the Tenuvial poem, my other favorite poem, and I'm going to do a full class where I'm going to mostly lecture, as we're going to be looking at the history of that poem, because the history of the A. Arendel Was a Mariner poem is, in my opinion, the most fascinating history of any of Tolkien's poems. In fact, when I was asked to contribute a chapter on Tolkien's poetry, for the Oxford Guide to Tolkien, I started off doing like a survey of Tolkien, and like it ended up just being like an in-depth discussion of this poem, basically, and its history, because it's not only like really cool and really fun, but for me it is one of the most illustrative moments in Tolkien's poetry as far as looking at how Tolkien's storytelling and his poetic composition kind of comes together. Sorry, Siri is yelling at me out of my watch for no obvious reason, like she does. Anyway, so that's going to be a lot of fun. So that's coming up, but we're probably not going to get there tonight. If we're exceptionally fortunate, we might do the first stanza tonight, but no promises. We're probably going to do that next week. Okay. So then let's jump into things. Just a couple announcements here this week. First, we have our two moots, which are coming up, of course, that I've been announcing. We've got New England Moot, which is coming up this coming Sunday. So Sunday week, basically, the 29th of September. So we're only a week and a half away now from our first ever New England Moot, which is super exciting. And that's going to be great. So you can register all the way up until the day of the event. So you can sort of show up and register there. But we can, or at least to the day before the event, at the least. But if you want food, register sooner rather than later, because we're going to have lunch and stuff too. So we want to make sure that we, you know arrangements for that. That's first. Second is Middle Moot, which is on October 12th. Out in Waterloo, Iowa. And again, you can register for that pretty much right up to the date. But again, if you want to eat, it's better for you to register sooner. So those are our two most proximate moots that are going to be happening very soon. But there is something going to be happening even sooner. And that is this coming Sunday, the 22nd of September, which is, of course, Bilbo and Frodo's birthday. And we are going to celebrate Bilbo and Frodo's birthday, as I have been doing at Signum for the last 6 or 7 years. That is going to be the beginning of our annual fall fundraising campaign for Signum University. So I'm going to do a broadcast on Sunday afternoon. It's going to be at 4:30 PM Eastern time. I tried to make that at a time which would work for most people. I know it's not going to work for absolutely everyone, like people in Japan, for instance, but you know, it should be okay for, from the West Coast of America out to Europe. So, anyway, 4:30 PM, Eastern time on Sunday, and we're going to do a broadcast. I'll broadcast it here on Twitch. We'll do a GoToWebinar session as well. That'll be up on the website tomorrow, the link for that. And anyway, so I'm going to first do a little bit of Signum updating, talking about sort of the state of things and where things are going. I'm not going to do my full State of the University address. That's going to be a little bit later on. But I'm going to do some updates and sort of share about the beginning of the campaign and tell you about some things that are going to be happening, some special events that we're going to be doing over the course of the campaign, including my next Lord of the Rings Online Marathon, which has been a traditional part of our fall fundraising campaign for a while. I'm going to get Wigand as close as I can get him to the Battle of Pelennor Field. So anyway, so that's going to happen too. So I'll be talking about the schedule for those things this coming Sunday. So plan to join me. We're also going to do some readings. I mean, it's Hobbit Day, so I'm going to do a long Tolkien reading. So not like exploring the Lord of the Rings. I'm not going to read a sentence and then talk about it. I'm going to read a long passage. And then we can have some discussion of the longer passage. So that's what's going to be happening this coming Sunday. Maybe we'll have some more readings. We'll see. We'll see what's going to be happening there. But it's going to be fun. So please do join me 4:30 p.m. Eastern time on Sunday the 22nd for our big kickoff event. And then into the following week. And then, of course, New England Moot is the week after that. So, that is the plan. That's all the announcements. Yep, those are all my announcements. Okay, excellent. Blue Wizard is saying he's excited for the prospect of a Tolkien professor Robert Plant crossover on Led Zeppelin. Yeah, I just got on Twitter we were talking about this. Someone was trying to connect me and Robert, because Robert Plant, the lead singer of Led Zeppelin, is doing a podcast where he's talking about a lot of his process, right, and his songwriting for Zeppelin. I've been a Zeppelin fan since I was 7, and so somebody was tweeting this afternoon, like, oh yeah, we should like do a Tolkien discussion on, you know, Tolkien's influence on Led Zeppelin. So I was like, hey, I'm all about this. And actually the Prancing Pony guys too were like, yeah, let's do a panel discussion on this. So yeah, I have no idea how we make it happen, actually. Like, so everybody go tweet to Robert Plant, at Robert Plant, tell him that we need to make this happen. I'm not quite sure how to make it happen, but if anybody wants to volunteer to help make that happen, I would love for that to happen. That would be really fun. That's been something actually I've been, you know, kind of toying with the idea of for many years, actually. There have been two like conversations I really want to have with songwriters, Tolkien conversations I want to have with songwriters. One is with Robert Plant, and the other is with the guys from Blind Guardian about their Nightfall and Middle-earth album. And I'm hopeful, who knows, maybe I can have them both before I die. We'll see. So what were they going to say? No, that's all I was going to say. All the announcements. So let us return to so my title for tonight is Not a Thing to Miss, referring of course to Elvish singing is not a thing to miss, as we're told in The Hobbit. And of course we're going to get our first exposure to Elvish singing, indirect exposure first, right? And then of course we'll get some direct exposure to singing, which is distinctively not Elvish singing, in fact, but Hobbit singing, as we will see. But first, a couple of long notes and queries. First, Beach 27 very kindly responded to my call last time when I was, you know, having that moment when Bilbo introduced Strider, right? I thought you at least knew enough to know Dúnedain, right? Man of the West, Numenorean. And I was trying to remember, wait a second. How does this strike us, right? If we try to separate ourselves from all of the years we have spent immersing ourselves in Tolkien lore and try to put ourselves back into the place of basically a first-time Lord of the Rings reader, what is the weight of that sentence when Bilbo says that? How many times has Numenor come up? What do we know about Numenor by that scene. So Beach 27 was supplying me with, said there's only one. He says there's very little about Numenor directly, as it happens, but it is interesting. According to my electronic copy, Numenor is spoken once in the text, before Bilbo connects it explicitly to Aragorn, and it's spoken by Aragorn himself at the end of his verbal lore appendix on Weathertop, post the Tale of Tenuviel. There live still those of whom Lúthien was the foremother, and it is said that her line shall never fail. Elrond of Rivendell is of that kin. For of Beren and Lúthien was born Dior Thingol's heir, and of him Elwing the White, whom Earendil wedded, he that sailed his ship out of the mists of the world into the seas of heaven, with the Silmaril upon his brow. And of Earendil came the kings of Numenor, that is, Westeros. Okay, so, several interesting things about this, right? One, if, you know, so this is the first reference to Numenor, in the text. Now, the little asterisk that Beach 27 put after spoken once in the text, the word is mentioned in the prologue, the Concerning Hobbits prologue, in the context of discussing architecture and the architectural influences on Hobbit structures, right? That they did get some of the things that from the Numenoreans. So the name comes up in that context. But I'm not too worried about that. That doesn't seem to me like hugely substantive. Indeed, in context, that reference to a first-time reader. So, assuming a first-time reader slogs through the whole Concerning Hobbits section prior to starting the story, that reference is just going to be totally puzzling, right? I mean, who are the Numenoreans, and why would they be influencing Hobbit architecture? I don't think any real information is going to be conveyed by that reference. So I agree with ignoring that one. So considering Strider's reference here as the first reference to Numenor, there are two things that seem very interestingly relevant to Bilbo's reference here in the Hall of Fire that we were just looking at last week. One is the overall context, right? Amidst all of these proper nouns that come peppering at us, you know, fast and furious in this paragraph, which I think would certainly probably make the head of a first-time reader spin. But the context of it is to talk about, there live still those of whom Lúthien was the foremother, right? So the subject of the paragraph is not Lúthien, right? It's coming out of the Lúthien story. It's about the descendants of Lúthien, right? There live still those of whom Lúthien was the foremother, and it is said that her line shall never fail. So there is an extent to which Aragorn is talking about himself here, his people, right? So here we're learning about those people of the ancient kings, this special people that are set aside. Her line shall never fail, right? There's something blessed about them. There's something special about them because they are the descendants of Lúthien. Again, the cause and effect is a little bit unclear, but the implication, right, is that there's some cause and effect there. And he gets around then eventually at the end to the kings of Numenor, that is Westeros, right? So he ties it through all of this elvish history. We get for of Beren and Lúthien was born Dior Thingol's heir, and of him Elwing, whom Earendil wedded, and of Earendil came the kings of Numenor. Which is interesting because, of course, the thing that he doesn't say is, you know, he says Elrond of Rivendell is of that kin. And then he goes on to describe Elrond's descent, right? Elrond's family tree. Beren and Lúthien to Dior to Elwing, connected to Earendil, and then the kings of Numenor, right? So he kind of skips Elrond at the end, like, oh, given Elrond, OPS also, the kings of Numenor. But again, although he mentions Elrond as the most famous example of living descendants of Lúthien, he traces the lineage of Elrond not to emphasize Elrond's lineage, but to emphasize the lineage of the kings of Numenor, or indeed that the lineage of the kings of Numenor is the same lineage as the lineage of Elrond, right? Which is also kind of interesting in the context of Aragorn introducing this, right? Which, again, when you think about it in the bigger picture of Aragorn's romantic situation, he is saying, you know, my my family wine is not only on a level, right, with my wife's, it's the same, actually. We're part of the same family, though separated by a number of generations, which is okay. That makes it non-creepy, by the way. It's all fine. Anyway, so that's the first thing. But again, the other thing that I would want to make sure that we emphasize here, notice that we get the reference to A. Arendel and his voyage, right? He that sailed his ship out of the mists of the world into the seas of heaven with the Silmaril upon his brow. So when Numenor is first introduced to us, it is linked to A. Arendel. A. Arendel gets the most press, you know, the most press, the most time, right, in that whole paragraph of any of the, you know, the rest of them. I mean, who is Dior Thingol's heir? The fact that he is Thingol's heir is the only thing we know, and since we don't know anything about Thingol except what we've heard just now during the plot synopsis, that doesn't mean all that much to us. Who is Elwing? Well, we don't know, except she's called the White for some reason, which is not explained, and that she marries A. Arendel, right? So we know very little about her, but A. Arendel, we're told more about, right? We get this whole clause about him, right? He that sailed his ship out of the mists of the world and into the seas of heaven with the Silmaril upon his brow, and of A. Arendel came the kings of Numenor, right? So A. Arendel is given a very central place. So A. Arendel is the really important descendant of Lúthien, right? We don't even mention, again, as I said, explicitly the fact that Elrond is his son. But anyway, again, just interesting to me that the very first time we get Numenor, we are given it explicitly in the context of A. Arendel, right? A. Arendel, the Mariner, Silmaril, voyage into the stars. Oh, by the way, Numenor, the Numenoreans came from him, right? Of A. Arendel came the kings of Numenor. And when Bilbo brings Numenor back up again, so the second time that the name has explicitly been said in the text, it's right before the A. Arendel was a Mariner poem, right? Oh, I thought you knew Dúnedain, man of the West, Numenorean, right? And then the next thing we're going to hear Bilbo saying is A. Arendel was a Mariner. So that is very interesting. And spiritual cushions, I agree with you, that Numenor, of course, was itself, in one of its names, named after A. Arendel's star, Elena, right? The land of the star. So, yeah, no, absolutely. And that's A. Arendel's star. So the link there is real, right? The link there is real. So, again, kind of interesting. Okay, but there's another one, right, where the word Numenor, like the actual name Numenor, isn't mentioned. But that's, of course, Gandalf's words to Frodo, right? Only a ranger, my dear Frodo, that is just what the rangers are, the last remnant in the north of the great people, the men of the west. They have helped me before, and I shall need their help in the days to come, for we have reached Rivendell, but the ring is not yet at rest. The great people, the men of the west. So he doesn't use the word Numenor here, right? But we've been reminded of the phrase men of the west recently, right? And Frodo has just in the previous paragraph used the phrase the old kings, right? The people of the old kings. So these are the people of the old kings, the great people, the men of the West. One of the things that's really noticeable, right, about these two, so these are the only two references that I can remember, right? Yes, the kings from over the sea. Gandalf refers to them as the kings from over the sea. Yeah, exactly. And I would say, of all of those things, like this whole conversation between Frodo and Gandalf, we are, unsurprisingly, because it's Frodo, right, who is the primary interlocutor here, right, he is, we're talking about the Numenoreans from a lower perspective, right, from the perspective of the residents of Middle-earth who were here the whole time and saw the Numenoreans return, right, the kings from over the sea, the great people, the men of the West. Right. Whereas in Strider's version, we're seeing them from the First Age perspective, not from the Third Age perspective, but from the First Age perspective. Right. Beren and Lúthien to Dior, to Elwing, to A. Arendel, to the Numenorean kings. Right. So they are the last of this very exalted family tree. Right. Well, them and Elrond. So anyway, so we get that right now. You're right, Sir Calidor. We get a very oblique memory of the Numenorean kings in Bombadil's vision, right? The line of kings that he sees, and the last one that comes with a star on his brow. But that's really something that we can kind of only understand in retrospect, right? That is a passage that I think is very, very, I can't imagine there are very many people who fully and accurately parse that vision their first time through the Lord of the Rings, right? Yeah, and good, Matt, exactly. We do know the hobbits have some kind of a memory of the Numenoreans in that they talk about whether people do or do not know of the king. Yeah, I was thinking about that too, Matt, that usage back in The Hobbit. That idea that, again, from the hobbit perspectives, the idea of the king is one, a thing of memory, right? But also of reverence, right? There is this reverent memory of the people of the old kings. That's definitely what I hear in Frodo's description, right? So we get both of these things. We are told that the Numenoreans are connected to all of that First Age stuff, right? All of those, that highest tradition. They are the descendants of Lúthien, whose line shall never fail, right? Through Eärendil, most importantly. And then we're told in Frodo and Gandalf's conversation that they're the people of the old kings, the great people, the people from the kings from across the sea, right? Yeah, so it's interesting that we get both of those angles, and that's it. That's all we know of the Numenoreans until we get Bilbo's comment, Dúnedain, Man of the West, Numenorean. It seems in some ways that this... I'm tempted to say that there is a way in which both of those two angles kind of come together here in this moment. That is, both the one in which they are seen from the point of view of the First Age, right, as sort of the last lingering descendants of the ancient world, right? They are these, like, walking memories of the ancient world who still go in secret among us, right? The people of the old kings, that's just what the rangers are. And then from the Hobbit perspective, right? And this seems to me something that's really kind of captured in this moment of recognition and in this moment of, you know, that what has been a slightly strange kind of suspense, right? Why did we need the reveal of Strider, right? We already met him before. He's not a surprise, right? And yet, we've been put through this elaborate unveiling of the fact that Strider and Dúnedain are the same person, right? And remember, this is going to be a thing that Tolkien's going to come back to, right? I am Strider and Dúnedain too, he is going to say later on, right? Remember, this is going to happen in the ruins of Isengard. This is going to come up again. This is going to come up again in the Houses of the Healing, right, with Merry. That, like, I am both. I am, you can look at me from different angles, and I'm going to look different from different angles, right? Is going to be kind of a thing with Aragorn. He is familiar to Frodo. He is the person who is dear, if dear is the right word for it, to him as a friend, right? But he is also going to be one of the people of the great kings. He's going to be this... one of these sort of legendary figures, right? And he's also going to be, you know, we're going to be reminded from the First Age standpoint that he's going to be one of these last lingering remnants of the ancient world in Middle-earth, and ultimately that's going to be his job description, right? Yeah. And it's true, Brandon, you know, you recall Numenor too closely, you never can be sure what's going to happen. You might trigger the greatest storm in modern history. Notion Club papers reference from our Wednesday night discussion. Matt is asking, how likely is Tolkien drawing on the legend of the lines of the kings of Britain coming from Troy? My guess, Matt, is that this is a kind of thing that Tolkien is doing one of those reverse echoes of, right? That is when you, when he, instead of like merely echoing a traditional story, he tells the story, which is like the original that the ancient story is like only a garbled version of. And that's, I think, what's going on here, right? He is posing the story of Numenor, the story of the Men of the West, as the true history, which lies behind many of the myths and legends that grew up later on. So the fact that Geoffrey of Monmouth, and you're right about that, Matt, the fact that Geoffrey of Monmouth traced the kings of Britain, right, back to the Trojans, right, who came through Rome, and then Brutus, who left Rome and landed in England, that this idea, you know, I think that Tolkien would say, or Tolkien seems to be sort of inviting us to think, that these ancient legends, exactly like Geoffrey of Monmouth, who are remembering this, have some kind of a dim sense, right, of like, these great kings came from across the sea, right, and they were embraced here, in our land, and have enriched our land, but that's a distant memory of Numenor, right, that's what that is. But anyway, absolutely spiritual cushions. We are in the midst of discussing, actually, we're in the home stretch now of discussing the Notion Club papers. In the Mythgard Academy, we are currently doing Sauron Defeated, we finished the last section of the history of the Lord of the Rings, and we did the unpublished epilogue, and now we've been doing the Notion Club papers now for, I don't know what, 9 sessions, maybe? It's been slow. I've been going slowly, not this slowly, but I've been going slowly through the Notion Club papers. I still have a couple sessions left. So that's Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern time is the live sessions. You can see all of our previous ones up to this point are on YouTube already. You can check in with that. We're really at the tail end now in our live discussions, so we'll be picking up again tomorrow. Maybe 2 weeks left, I think. Tying up the last unfinished stuff at the end. But anyway, yeah, Notion Club papers are really mind-blowing. And if you read the Notion Club papers carefully, you will learn more about how Tolkien thinks and how Tolkien wrote than I think anywhere else in any of Tolkien's writings. That's certainly the conclusion I have come to after this study of the Notion Club papers that we've been doing over the last couple months. It's been really mind-blowing on occasion. Difficult in many places, but mind-blowing in lots of them. But anyway, I digress. Okay, so thank you, Beach27, for confirming my suspicion that these were the only places that we talked about Numenor, and I'm not sure that I remembered clearly the reference there in Strider's epilogue to the Tenuvio poem, so thank you for reminding me of that. One more, though it's another long one, but hopefully I don't think it should take quite as long. Saxo Runesinger was saying, in episode 112, we talked about Elrond's joking comment about Bilbo's poem in progress, and we will hear it and judge it before we end our merrymaking. The conclusion from discussion, and in further discussions in session 113, was that Elrond, capable of code-switching with his friend the Little Master, was engaging in hobbitry and was not really going to judge so harshly after all. But having recently read Diana Glyer's Bandersnatch, which is a great book, which describes the creative collaboration between Tolkien and the Inklings, I have a notion that Tolkien's experience and expectation would be that such critique would be appropriately and understandably honest, since anything short of this would be disingenuous. Why would the folk of Rivendell have any other style of appreciation of a work in progress? Having spent 17 years with this crowd, Bilbo would know these rules, which is why he missed the feast in order to be prepared. Now, I agree. First of all, I think that that's a great perspective and certainly a good thing to remember that, you know, in the context of Inklings discussions and things like that, just sort of the creative culture, as you say, that Tolkien was living in, he wouldn't have, you know, the idea of somebody judging your poem would not have been merely terrifying or some kind of threat, right? That would be a good thing. So I agree with you to an extent, and I certainly don't think and didn't mean to imply that Elrond and the other elves would be disingenuous. Like, if they heard Bilbo's poem and thought it was junk, that they would just be like, oh, that, yeah, no, really good, Bilbo. I really love that. I wouldn't expect the elves to do that at all. But here's the thing. Here's the one kind of caveat that I have to this argument. The reason I think, again, I'm not saying I think that there's going to be disingenuousness here, but the reason I think that Elrond is still I still hold to the fact that he's sort of joking a little bit here. As Bilbo is going to say himself, is going to say to Frodo that, like, it's, his poetry is not really up to Rivendell standards, right? He knows this. And I think that this is not just a purely qualitative assessment on his part, right? It's not merely that, like, oh, I'm really not as good a poet as these elves, right? It's not just that. He's doing a completely different kind of thing. And I think it's going to be very hard for them to judge it in the same way. That is, judge in the sense of giving, you know, honest criticism of. And I think we're going to see that borne out in the brief critical conversation that happens after the poem, right? So, anyway, I still think that the idea that Elrond is saying, like, we're going to, you know, and we're going to respond and tell you all of the flaws in your poem, I still do think that they are, let's see, the way that I would compare it is, and this seems to me, honestly, actually a fairly apt comparison. If you were to say something like this to a child, right, like an 8-year-old who had composed a poem, you could say it quite honestly, right? You could give them very serious and genuine. Again, I'm not saying that you would have to, like, you know, any poem an 8-year-old composes, you have to be like, oh, that was fabulous, that was great. No, I think it's better to tell them, like, yeah, you know, that was good, but, you know, I would, you know, make suggestions and say, oh, this part I think wasn't as good as that part. Like, I'm not, there's no reason not to do that kind of thing, even with a child. But there's a different kind of standard that one is going to use, right? One isn't going to just put it next to, you know, you know, you're not going to put it next to the great poems of the English language and be like, well, you know, okay, it really wasn't, you know, let's compare it. You're not going to do that, right? You're going to respond to it on its level. And I think that that's how they would respond to it on its level, with appreciation, which means with a real and sincere critical response. But what Elrond says about, like, we shall hear it and judge it, I think still the tone of that still sounds to me like it's designed to be deliberately off-putting, right? You know, like, we are going to form a tribunal and we are going to assess, you know, whether your poem is, your new poem is up to scratch, right? But I also do agree with your emphasis. Bilbo clearly takes it seriously. He knows that his poem is, like, it's a big deal for his poem to be performed in the Hall of Fire, right, in front of everybody. And he's going to know, of course, it's a doubly big deal for his poem about Eärendil to be recited in front of Elrond himself when Elrond has just told him that he's going to judge it. So I'm not at all suggesting that he doesn't take that seriously either. So there's definitely some real and constructive intensity there that I can absolutely see. But I still think that there's that air of teasing in Elrond's comment, right? He is deliberately making it sound like they are going to form a hostile tribunal to assess his work, which is, I think, not exactly the way that things are going to go down. Now, Morwen, I agree that this isn't the first poem that Bilbo has crafted there, and they know his style. But this is not just a style question. It's not just a style question. Well, let me save that. Actually, no. Let me move on to the second half of Saxo Runesinger's, whose name I forgot to put on the slide, Saxo Runesinger's comment. Also, in Class 113, he says, there was some discussion of the elves' probable delight in the Hobbit's linguistic translation of their tales and poems. No doubt this was new to them. To the extent that they had encountered the art of mortals, it would have been most likely that of the men of the West, who would have largely adopted elvish styles and forms, and probably would have read and recited them in Sindarin. Of course, for some of these, even a Sindarin version would have been a translation from Quenya, and the elves probably hadn't seen much of their material in Westron at all, certainly not in the Westron of the Shire, a very colloquial and informal dialect, as will be confirmed, of course, later on in the story. But then the fact that it was a Hobbit's translation would have offered yet another layer of interest. Hobbit poetry has its own meter, but also there is a trend to adapt, modify, and recontextualize a given work to suit a particular situation, e.g. How the Road Goes Ever On is transformed in the story at different readings. This approach would have also been new and interesting to the folk of Rivendell. Yes, again, we're going to get some direct evidence after Bilbo's poetry that there is something to the elves. Bilbo's poetry is not just, it's not just that it's like Bush League poetry, right? This is not just like, you know, bad poetry or kind of embarrassing. It's just alien poetry, very different from how the elves think and express themselves. It is my suspicion that the Tale of Tenuviel, right, based on what Aragorn says about it after he recites it, about the mode that it's written in and stuff, is that the actual words that he says, the Westron translation of the poem that he sings or recites for the hobbits in Weathertop, is probably his own adaptation, right, his own translation of the poem. So he has adapted it into Westron. Has he ever done that for anybody at Rivendell? Has he ever sung the Westron version of the Tale of Tenuviel and the Hall of Fire? I'm not sure he would have done. Right? Maybe. But JJ, that's a pretty good metaphor, I think, that it's like trying to judge a Japanese haiku based on English poetry standards. Yes. I mean, I remember the first time I ever heard a haiku, and I didn't get it at all. I'm like, how is that a poem? Like, I don't understand. That just sounds like a sort of a slightly, you know, gnomic saying, but I don't understand how it's poetry. Right? Because again, like, just to me, it didn't sound like poetry at all, because it operates under a totally different set of poetic rules. So that, I think, is perhaps similar. We are going to have, I think, some evidence of this later in the work. This is a theory I came up with when I was doing my Tolkien's poetry class at Signum, which I first taught a few years back. And my theory is that there is going to be one poem in The Lord of the Rings where we are going to see, where we're really going to be able to taste clearly the alienness of elvish poetry compared to Westron poetry. There are times when elvish song is going to be adapted into Westron, right, by Aragorn, in the translation that is going to be given by Frodo of Galadriel's song, right, which she speaks in Quenya. There's going to be things like that, right? But those are Westron versions. That's not a direct. It conceals the alienness of the elvish verse because it's filtered through a hobbit filter, right? Those ultimately what we're going to be seeing when we see a lot of these versions of elvish poetry is going to be hobbit versions. Remember, we got this in the Elbereth poem from in the Shire, right? And you know, from Gildor, I mean, right, when they show up and chase the rider away. Remember, that translates itself in their heads. The verse that we see on the page, the verse that we read, that's hobbit poetry. We talked about this a little bit at the time. So that's not actually how elvish poetry works. That's how hobbit poetry works. It's very familiar to us, right? It sounds familiar, it sounds normal. But elvish poetry isn't really exactly like that. Anyway, so So yes, so I do. I think that Saxo Rinsinger is exactly right here. I think that their curiosity about Bilbo is going to make it hard. I mean, just like, again, I know a little bit more about haikus now than I did when I first heard them when I was in school. But, you know, I still don't know much about it, and I don't know anything like enough Japanese in order to really get a feel for how that is supposed to work poetically, and how that certainly, could I judge? Am I really in a good position to judge, like, what makes a good haiku and a bad haiku? I don't feel that I am. I don't feel that I could really explain the difference. You know, if you gave me a good haiku and a bad haiku and said, yeah, okay, that one's good and that one's bad, I'm not sure I would be able to see it or express it, especially since, again, I kind of think I would need to know a lot more Japanese before I could understand that, right? And again, I think that we're going to see a similar gap. Really, actually, a similar but more profound gap. That is just between two different language groups, among two different mortal peoples right here, separated merely by an ocean. The gap between elves and hobbits is much more profound. So I do think that Saxo is really onto something here. And this is, again, why I think... there is a little bit of joking fiction behind the idea of we shall hear it and judge it, right? Because the only judge that we're going to hear from, the only elvish judge we're going to hear from after Bilbo's poem is exactly going to say, I can't judge this, right? He's not going to offer any constructive criticisms at all of Bilbo's work, and not just because he doesn't care, and not just because he's apathetic, but because he's like, yeah, dude, not qualified, right? I can't, I don't, it's over my head. I mean, he responds to it, again, kind of artistically, the way that I respond to haiku. So yeah, I think that's a really good metaphor. I like that, or simile, technically. Okay, cool. Anyway, we'll come back to this. This is a little teaser for the poem, which we're almost there, and I think that we'll be able to see pretty quickly. Vainamoinen's comment was, haikus are easy, but sometimes they don't make sense. Refrigerator. Yeah, that's... I assume, Vainamoinen, you're putting... or Valamoinen, sorry. You're putting that forward as an example of an excellent haiku so that I can learn about what makes a good haiku good, right? Because that works for me. Anyway, so... we will... One of the things that we will be looking at right away is the hobbitness of Bilbo's poem, right? I will see that, I think, in the first stanza of it. Good. Brandon points out that, you know, elves don't usually tell you what they think as well, right? Which is true, which is another thing which leads me to question whether or not the Hall of Fire at Rivendell really is the same kind of... the same kind of constructive, critical, you know, sort of creative community, right, that Tolkien was a part of. How inklings-like would the Hall of Fire be? I really am not sure at all that it would be very inklings-like, actually. And again, if you want to know a little bit about what an inklings meeting probably was like, read the Notion Club papers, right? That's Tolkien's fictionalized version of an inklings meeting. You know, his like pseudo inklings sessions, right? And again, I cannot imagine the elves of Rivendell talking like that to each other. I really can't. Anyway, okay. The text. So, here we go. Well, my dear fellow, said Bilbo, now you've heard the news, can't you spare me a moment? So, this is to Strider, right? Who said that he was sorry he couldn't be there at the feast because there was that news that he had here, and we talked about how bad Strider is at hobbitry, right? He doesn't get the banter thing. "Well, my dear fellow," said Bilbo, "now you've heard the news. Can't you spare me a moment? I want your help in something urgent. Elrond says this song of mine is to be finished before the end of the evening, and I am stuck. Let's go off into a corner and polish it up." Strider smiled. "Come then," he said. "Let me hear it." Frodo was left to himself for a while, for Sam had fallen asleep. He was left alone and felt rather forlorn, although all about him the folk of Rivendell were gathered. But those near him were silent, intent upon the music of the voices and the instruments, and they gave no heed to anything else. Frodo began to listen. Okay. So I think that Bilbo's "well, my dear fellow," notice how Bilbo is kind of unrelentingly like jovial, or like his hobbitry towards Strider does not relent, despite the fact that Strider is not returning it, right? He is not reciprocating the tone at all of Bilbo's, including Bilbo's, as we discussed last time, rather cheeky reference to the Lady Arwen, right, previously. And Strider's very deadpan response, "Well, my dear fellow, now that you've heard the news, can't you spare me a moment?" Right? Here's me resolutely not taking what you've said seriously. Bilbo could respond with something that says, you know, like, "Oh, yeah, you know, I understand, Strider. Like, you know, I know you had serious business, but, you know, if you have time, you know, could—" No, you know, he's like, he basically dismisses him. "Now that you've heard the news," right? "Okay, so you've gotten your super important work over, right? Now, can't you spare me a minute?" Anyway, I think that that's interesting. An interesting kind of reflection. We know that, I mean, he has been, Strider has been introduced here as Bilbo's friend, right? Bilbo's special friend, Dunedain, whoever that is, right? So we know that the two of them are friends, even though we do not see Strider interacting with Bilbo in this, jocund and lighthearted way. Bilbo continues to talk to him like a friend, right? Like he would talk to one of his friends. And I love the combination of both flippancy about Strider's business and self-deprecation towards himself, right? "I want your help in something urgent," right? "Now that you've heard the news, I've got something really important," right? And then he lays it out like this. It's this portentous thing. "Elrond says this song of mine is to be finished before the end of the evening, and I'm stuck." Now, of course, we're going to learn that this is not exactly true, right? That Bilbo has, in fact, the poem is pretty much done. And Aragorn is going to contribute very little towards the poem at all. But he makes it sound like, you know, again, this is a huge, huge deal, right? Let's go off into a corner and polish it up. Brandon points out that he loves that Aragorn seems to consider Bilbo's request for poetry help as important, as something urgent. You know, he doesn't contradict Bilbo. Even though, of course, you know, so he does not say, like, "Yeah, well, look, no, seriously, like, what I was doing, it was actually urgent." Again, Strider, he doesn't do the hobbitry thing very well, but he gets it, right? And he smiles, right? He enjoys it. He enjoys Bilbo. He understands Bilbo. He acknowledges the joke by smiling not, Brandon, as you say, not, you know, contradicting him or anything like that. And yes, Matt, you're right. Matt is thinking about the earlier parallel to when, Gandalf does his, you know, buzzkill Lord of the Rings speech, right? And Pippin, rolls his eyes and brushes it off, right? Gandalf has been saying many cheerful things like that, right? Yes, there is a kind of kingly forbearance, I think, looking at your name there, Davis, on Twitter. Yeah, there is a kind of kingly forbearance to his tone here, I think. But again, this is not, I think, he's not holding himself aloof, I think. You know, this just seems to me that he is reciprocating in his own idiom, right? He doesn't do Bilbo's idiom, but he does, you know, meet his friendship. Yes, exactly. His lack of hobbitry is not due to a lack of appreciation for it. He's not deaf to it, nor is he hostile to it, nor does he have no sense of humor. This is just, it's not his mode. He doesn't do it. No, I agree. As far as what the news was, it is possible, of course, that Elrond and Elro here had still been out searching for Frodo. I mean, you know, there was nobody to text them to say that the ring bearer's in, you know, it's okay to come back now. So they probably were still searching for Frodo, but of course, what they would presumably be coming home right now, what the news that Aragorn was probably most eager to hear is, where are the Ringwraiths, right? What happened to them? They got washed downstream in the flood, so what next, right? Where are they? Is almost certainly, I would think, what Aragorn is most interested to hear. And we don't know exactly when they went out, right? So they may have been back since Frodo arrived and, you know, have gone out again. I'm very strongly suspecting that it was news of the Black Riders that they were going out for. Catriona says, this is like how many people often want to have a friend read their paper or listen to their presentation as a practice run or whatever, and probably Bilbo's used Aragorn as a testier before, so Aragorn knows he just has to go listen and be encouraging. Probably, yeah. I mean, Catriona, you think back to the discussion we were just having about poetry, right? Strider is going to be one of the few other people in Rivendell who's going to get Bilbo, for whom Bilbo's poetry is not going to be alien, right? He is now, again, I agree with Saxo Runesinger that the Numenoreans, although, you know, the elves' interactions with the Numenoreans would have had them be acquainted to some extent with mortals, right? And the differences between mortals and elves. The gap between elves and Numenoreans is nothing like the gap between elves and hobbits, right? Which means, you know, the logical extension of that observation is that Numenoreans, a.k.a. Strider, right, are actually there as a kind of a middle ground between the elves and the hobbits. So Strider is therefore the perfect test audience for Bilbo, right? Because he's not, I mean, if there were another elf that Bilbo was particularly close with, he could take him aside and sing it for him and be like, what do you think? And the elf would be like, I think what I always think. I don't get it, right? Whereas Aragorn is able both to receive it a little bit more easily, but also he's a little closer to the rest of the audience, right? So he is used to being kind of in between, I think, a little bit more, as his own earlier poem shows, right? He also, like Bilbo. Do we have any other examples? I don't think we have any other examples, right? I mean, so far as I know, the people who are translating Elvish song and lore into Westron poetry is a two-person club so far, right? Well, Sam, arguably, right? But the only thing from Elvish lore specifically was the Gilgalad poem, which we know he was Bilbo's and not Sam's. But anyway, yeah. But Belongsmond, you're right. Despite the fact that Aragorn is also an Elvish translator like Bilbo, he does not, apparently, like Bilbo, have the cheek to recite it in the Hall of Fire in front of Elrond, especially the poems that are about Elrond's dad. Exactly. Ambrosius Aurelius, Ambrosius Aurelianus is speculating that Aragorn has probably had a lot of practice in not accidentally offending Elrond while when trying to rhapsodize on Elvish matters. Probably so. Probably, again, he would be the perfect test argument. And I do presume that Aragorn had lots of training in writing poetry. And again, unlike a lot of the elves, I wonder how many of the elves are, you know, render these elvish modes of poems into Westron, into the common speech. Is that a hobby among the elves? Maybe there are elves who do that. But definitely not, it's definitely not all of them. Right. By the way, you know, whenever we're talking about elvish poetry, somebody's always going to make someone's always gonna make a tra-la-la-lolly joke, right? I think that really just kind of proves my point, right? The tra-la-la-lolly songs, I mean, it's one of the arguments that I was making in my Hobbit book that I think that we see, like, the elvish poems are weird. They're not weird in poetic form, exactly. I mean, they scan normally and stuff like that. But they... they're weird, right? I mean, they sound strange. They sound silly and ridiculous and just odd. And again, I think that it's supposed to, that Tolkien really is trying to capture a different way of looking at the world in those poems, even when he's doing, you know, in the context of sort of slightly sillier context of The Hobbit. Ambrosius, I also wonder what Aragorn's training really involved. It would be fascinating to think of the educational curriculum for Aragorn, young Aragorn. I mean, he was quite young he was like two when he came to Rivendell, so he would not have been taught anything by his father or among his father's people, but his mom was there, right? Gilrain would have taught him. And I would have thought that Gilrain would have taken the primary role in teaching him. But of course, almost certainly, Elrond would also have been involved, right? So exactly where were the lines there? This, of course, was something that we played with in the frame of season one of the Silm Film project, imagining and some of the potential tensions that might have arisen, right? We were sort of imagining, maybe Gilrain and Elrond might not have seen eye to eye on this at all times. Good. Okay. Frodo being alone. So Sam has fallen asleep. Now, as Tom points out, is Sam really asleep? You can't really tell. On the one hand, he's fallen asleep just like he did at Woodhall, right? So I too have my doubts as to whether or not Sam is actually asleep. At the same time, I can believe that Sam has fallen asleep in truth. We're going to see in the next slide what's going to happen to Frodo when he begins listening to the song, right? It is my theory. So Ambrosius, yes, that's one thing. One thing is, Sam's not been sleeping all that much, right? He's been sitting by Frodo's bedside as much as they will allow him to do. They send him away to get some sleep sometimes, but I doubt that. I feel pretty confident that on this, the first day that Frodo is up and about, Sam is still dealing with a fair backlog of sleep deprivation. Okay, that seems to me very likely. So the idea that Sam would, after the feast, here in the Great Hall by the fire, lie down and drop off pretty quickly, I know I would in those circumstances. I could be asleep in less than 30 seconds in that circumstance. So that's, you know, fine. But when we see what's going to happen to Frodo, one of the things that I wonder is Sam's falling asleep here a sign or an indicator of the fact that he started listening to the Elvish singing before Frodo did, which wouldn't surprise me at all. And yes, Tom, I agree that being asleep during an elvish performance is a permeable state. Yes, I do suspect that it is rather like, sorry, not to do too many crossovers here, but just like in the Notion Club papers. My favorite character in the Notion Club papers is Dolbear, who is always listening to the pseudo-Inklings meetings, the Notion Club meetings, while asleep, right? So he'll be sitting there dozing off the entire meeting, and then he'll perk up and show that he's been understanding everything that everybody said, despite the fact that he was asleep. And this, in the context of the discussion that they're having in the Notion Club papers, is actually super relevant and totally plausible. And yeah, so I think that the experience that Sam is having, Sam is, I think, not just dropped off and is snoring. I think that Sam is kind of in another place right now, right? Asleep in a sense, not asleep in another sense, perhaps. Genuinely tired, I'm sure. But Endang's asking, do I think Bilbo was concerned with Frodo? Maybe asking Elrond what is wrong, like a patient's head of the family asking a doctor at the ER. You mean now, like when he sneaks off, you know, does he pop over to Elrond and be like, dude, did you see that? Like, should I be worried? I wouldn't think so here. First, because I believe with Saxo Runesinger, I believe that Bilbo is taking his poetic performance quite seriously and really does want to run it past Aragorn. But at the same time, I think the primary reason that I don't think that he's sneaking off and talking to Elrond is the fact that I think he gets it. He doesn't need Elrond's explanation, right? He understands. I think, because I'm a big believer in the moment of insight that Bilbo just had. I think that insight was pretty profound there. Anyway, yeah. So I think he gets it. He gets it. He doesn't need another explanation from the ER doctor. Yeah. Okay. He was alone and felt rather forlorn, although all about him the folk of Rivendell were gathered. That's a really interesting kind of statement to make. Why should Frodo feel forlorn? Even rather forlorn. I mean, Merry and Pippin are presumably around somewhere. They've got to be in the room, right? Gandalf's in the room. Glowin's in the room, right? Even if Bilbo and Strider go off to talk about his poem, leaving Frodo by himself with a now, at least apparently, somnolent Sam, there's just no shortage of potential conversational partners, right? Why exactly should he feel rather forlorn here? Although all about him the folk of Rivendell were gathered. Yeah, Catriona, I can't help but think that too, right? It's just a couple paragraphs before we saw Frodo isolated within the room, right? All around him is the song of merriment and music talk and everything. And all of a sudden he's in this bubble of silence, right? Everything drops. So it's like the rest of the room doesn't exist anymore. That's when the shadow comes between him and Bilbo and he is completely engulfed, ultimately in his own desire for the ring, right? Having that little moment with the ring. I don't know that I would go quite so far as to say that he is having a relapse here, like that his forlorn feeling is evidence that the ring is afflicting him again here. I think it's saying it a little too strongly. But to say that this is an echo or a kind of holdover, right, as Lady Shmebulak and Flamifer are both suggesting here, that he's still kind of recovering from it. That this is kind of an Odal Ring hangover there. Yeah, that makes to me much more sense, that there is something. Remember, he's had the conversation with Bilbo about news from the Shire, right? So Bilbo has done his best to kind of reintegrate Frodo, right? And it worked. We saw, you know, he could hear the music again, and he's back into sort of sensory contact with the room around him, which is a great sign. But is this still kind of a lingering holdover of that experience. Again, it's, I can't understand it, because it's not even like he's in a room full of strangers. It's totally not full of strangers. At the very least, Merry, Pippin, and Gandalf are all in the room. That does strike me as a little bit odd, and that does seem to me, the holdover idea seems to me the best way to think about that. Especially because in the subordinate clause in the second half of the sentence, the narrator emphasizes that, although all about him, the folk of Rivendell were gathered, right? So he's feeling forlorn in the midst of a crowd, which suggests it's him, it's not them, right? People aren't being friendly. People aren't being off-putting to Frodo. People aren't giving him the cold shoulder. This is him. It's not them. I wonder, Ambrosius, if he's also perhaps feeling a little left out of Bilbo's confidence since he wasn't invited to help with the poem. Maybe. That he could be kind of grudging that in a sense, or that he wasn't included, right? And that Bilbo left him behind. Maybe. I don't know. I don't think that he necessarily grudges it. Yeah, Brunir was wondering a similar thing. Is it, you know, because he's like, what, dude, I haven't seen Bilbo in 17 years, and now after like half an hour, he's, you know, running off and being like, hang on, you know, I got this thing. Yeah, exactly. He's jilted me for his new friend, Belongsmond, exactly. There might be an element of that there. Or again, that itself might be another way of saying exactly the same thing, right? Saying that, that he is feeling that way about Bilbo, in part, that itself is part of this emotional aftertaste, as you say, Toramarthen, or sort of holdover from that isolating, shadowy ring experience, right? That kind of suspiciousness, resentment, is like a shadow of the shadow that comes between him and Bilbo, right? Is that shadow's shadow now coming between him and Bilbo again, in a sense? I think that seems very, very possible. But those near him were silent, intent upon the music of the voices and the instruments, and they gave no heed to anything else. Frodo began to listen. So let's look at what happens when he listens. At first, the beauty of the melodies and of the interwoven words in elven tongues, even though he understood them little, held him in a spell as soon as he began to attend to them. Almost it seemed that the words took shape, and visions of far lands and bright things that he had never yet imagined opened out before him, and the firelit hall became like a golden mist above seas of foam that sighed upon the margins of the world. Then the enchantment became more and more dreamlike, until he felt that an endless river of swelling gold and silver was flowing over him, too multitudinous for its pattern to be comprehended. It became part of the throbbing air about him, and it drenched and drowned him. Swiftly, he sank under its shining weight into a deep realm of sleep. There he wandered long in a dream of music that turned into running water, and then suddenly into a voice. It seemed to be the voice of Bilbo chanting verses. Faint at first, and then clearer, ran the words. Okay. Lady Shmebiok says, it reminds me of the siren singing, only less death. Yes, distinctly less death. Yes, so this is, Belongsmond says, I'll have what he's having. Yeah, the depiction of, this is one of the most remarkable depictions of enchantment in Tolkien. We get our first glimpse of this kind of thing in Bilbo, right, in chapter one of The Hobbit, when he's listening to the dwarf song and has that dwarvish experience, right, as a result. This is described a little bit more clearly. So his first response, let's kind of try to piece it out item by item here. At first, the beauty of the melodies and of the interwoven words in elven tongues, even though he understood them little, held him in a spell as soon as he began to attend to them. So he is first just kind of mesmerized by the two beauties, right? The beauties of the melodies. So we've got the actual music itself, and we have the interwoven words in elven tongues. And notice this has nothing to do with the beauty of the song in any kind of denotation sense. He doesn't understand it, right? He does not understand the words. He understands them little, but they hold him in a spell. He is enchanted by the beauty of the interwoven words as soon as he attends to them. Almost it seems that the words took shape. So first is just, again, that being mesmerized by the beauty of it. What he's hearing, him being held in a spell. Kind of like me with rap music. But anyway, almost it seemed that the words took shape, and visions of far lands and bright things that he had never yet imagined opened out before him. And the fire lit home. So now we have the enchantment really setting in. Not just his experience of the... So first he's having an aesthetic experience, right? He's experiencing the beauty of the combination of song and words, right? Then he moves from an aesthetic experience to a sub-created experience, right? And remember Tolkien's concept of fairy and drama, that is the logical extension of the artistic of artistic sub-creation, right? When you're reading a good story, you get drawn into it. Right. And in your imagination, it's like you're there and you can lose sight of all the world around you and get drawn into the story, and hours can go by that you don't notice. Right. All of these things that happen to us when we're reading or listening to a really good book. Well, the logical extension, Tolkien argues, and on fairy stories of that experience, is what he calls fairy and drama. Humans can't really accomplish this, but elves can when they actually you. The art is so good that you mistake it for the primary world. So you yourself, just in your waking world, it's like you're in a dream, except you're awake, right? You are in fact transported. All of your senses are transported. That what is like you're taking in artistically becomes sensory input, right? And we see that transition happen. The words take shape. And visions of far lands and bright things that he had never yet imagined opened out before him, right? So that opening, right, is him being ushered into this. And notice, this is not just him being... This is one thing that this experience has in common with Bilbo's in Chapter 1 of The Hobbit, right? In both cases, and I think that this is a really important element of this, it's not like a memory that is being evoked for him. Right, he is not being. This is not tying into. He's not relating to this. To use the really, really tired way of talking about art that we do almost exclusively in the 21st century. Can I relate to it? I shouldn't roll my eyes too heavily when I say that. I'm not saying that that's unimportant at all, but the way that we in the 21st century tend to treat that as if that's the only evaluative question that's appropriate to ask. Like, if the answer is no, I can't relate to it, then it's bad. Like, it's not worth reading. And that is so, so sad for exactly this reason. When one is enchanted, the beauty of enchantment, the miracle of enchantment, the opportunity that that provides is for you to be transported not into your own memories, not into your own experience, but into something completely different, where you begin to experience the world in a completely new way through the artistic lens of someone who is fundamentally different from you. Bilbo hears the song of the dwarves and he suddenly, briefly, looks at the world from a dwarvish perspective and feels the dwarvish desire in his own heart, which is very alien to his normal thinking, right? That doesn't come from him. That is something that he has received through the artistic action. Right, of the dwarves' song. Yeah, Belongsmon, he loses himself, as it were. Yeah. Well played. But anyway, yes. But this is done even more extraordinarily here, right? Bilbo just gets a little taste of it in chapter one. Frodo has the much fuller fairy and drama experience here. Visions of far lands. So he sees lands that he's never seen. And bright things that he had never yet imagined open out before him, right? Things that were outside of his imagination. Now, keep in mind, this is also something like the classic definition of fantasy. The difference between fantasy and imagination, according to like medieval nomenclature, right? The way that those two words were used in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, Shakespeare still uses these words in this way. So when Shakespeare talks about imagination, he is not talking about creativity at all. When Shakespeare uses the word imagination, or imagine, he is referring to the psychological faculty for conjuring up mental images of things, right? You know, so like right now, I can picture, you know, what is going on. I can hear noises from upstairs as my oldest son is getting ready for bed, and I can picture what is probably happening up there, right? I can picture, you know, him getting ready for bed and plugging in his phone, which is probably happening right now, right? I can conjure that image in my head, even though it's absent to my eyes, right? Fantasy is when your imagination constructs images that you have never seen with your senses, right? Especially things that nobody has ever seen with their senses, right? So when you imagine fantastical things that are fantastical, when that word is used, a fantastical thing, again, when Shakespeare uses the word fantastical, who is it, Lucio, who refers to the Duke in Measure for Measure as the old fantastical Duke of Dark Corners. What he means when he says fantastical is from the fantasy, like somebody who conjures up crazy things that nobody has ever seen before. That's like the experience that Frodo's having, except it's not him. It doesn't come from him. It comes from, this is him experiencing the fantasy of someone else, right? Or at least it feels like fantasy to him, because it's not out of his these are not images out of his experience, right? Or out of his memory. This is something, that which is art to them, that which is possibly memory to them, is for him this sort of ultimate fantastic experience, right? Arden Crayon, yeah, boy, that would be a great paper, wouldn't it? That would be an excellent moot paper, Arden Crayon. Compare The Hobbit's enchantment at Woodhall with their enchantment at Bombadil's house with Frodo's enchantment here. Yeah, yeah, do that. That would be a great paper. What do we learn about enchantment? What are some of the different things that we can see and the similarities and differences between that kind of experience that they have in those places? I think that's great. Matt says Tolkien might be echoing Keats on first looking into Chapman's Homer in this passage. Remind me, I'm not remembering the lines that he said, I believe you, but I'm not remembering my Keats well enough to recall the lines that you're thinking of. Golden mist. All right, okay. And the firelit hall became like a golden mist above the seas of foam that sighed upon the margins of the world. The firelit hall became like a golden mist above seas of foam that sighed upon the margins of the world. Again, notice the progression, right? The aesthetic experience, the perception of beauty, right? And then it seemed that the words took shape. Visions open out before him. And then the firelit hall became, right? Now we have, like, the world around him is now completely transformed. You know, we had the vision opening up, but now the vision has engulfed his senses. He is no longer aware of the firelit hall around him. Now, in place of the firelit hall, you have a golden mist above seas of foam that sighed upon the margins of the world. That's what the elves are singing about. That's what the elves are thinking about. They're thinking about Elvenhome. They're thinking about Valinor. They're thinking about the sea that lies between them. They're thinking about the margins, right? The edge of the world. Yeah, I agree, Carita. The margins of the world is a very lovely phrase. In fact, I think that's one of the... I mean, Tolkien does this quite a lot, really. There are many times when Tolkien will produce a phrase which is like a myth, right? Like it's an entire myth contained in one phrase. I agree with you. That's one of those mythic phrases, I think, the margins of the world. That phrase is like a story. It's like a poem all in itself, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, cool, Matt. Yeah, great. I saw it briefly and then it passed by me. Much have I traveled in the realms of gold and many goodly states and kingdoms seen. Round many western islands have I been, which bards and fealty to Apollo hold. Oft of one wide expanse had I been told that deep-browed Homer ruled as his domain, yet did I never breathe its pure serene till I heard Chapman speak out loud and bold. Then felt I like some watcher of the skies when a new planet swims into his ken, or like stout Cortez when with eagle eyes he stared at the Pacific and all his men looked upon each other with a wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien. Yeah, no, I agree. There's definitely some interesting parallels there. You've got the enchantment thing, right? His description, Keats's description of being enchanted when he reads Homer, but also of him imagining Homer in this kind of transport as well. Yeah, and then, of course, the specific details of the vision, the realms of gold, and the round many western islands I have been, the wide expanse and the deep-browed home. Yeah, no, I think there are definitely some interesting echoes here. Of course, that is a super modern poem, right? I mean, that's pretty newfangled. But again, you have to be a little bit... I mean, you always have to take... I want to be cautious saying this because, of course, one can go too far in this direction. But one does always have to take Tolkien's proclamations with a grain of salt sometimes. He was fond of making sweeping statements which weren't always necessarily totally accurate, right? Like, people will quote places where he says that, like, you know, he disliked all French things, and we'll take that sometimes a little bit too seriously, right? He borrows a lot of French things, in fact, and in fact shows a great deal of inclination towards many French things, despite his protestations, right? And similarly, you know, when you hear Tolkien write off anything written before 1500, you know, or anything written after 1500, rather, again, like that, yes, that's true, but does that mean he didn't read Keats? Yeah, no, he had read Keats. You can't exactly grow up and attend a school, like Tolkien did, King Edward School, without reading, you know, poetry. Anyway, yeah, so we have to be a little bit careful. So yeah, did he know that? I suspect. I suspect so. I mean, I suspect that he knew the poem, certainly. Was he deliberately making parallels? I don't know. I mean, could be a kind of coincidence, right? Yeah, Torrhe Marth and the allegory thing is a classic example, and a classic example especially of people taking him too seriously. I mean, there's so many Tolkien fans who very understandably, you know, very sort of faithfully are like defending Tolkien's kind of hyperbolic statement, right, about his dislike of allegory, when of course he does in fact make allegories quite self-consciously and openly and talks about it. Exactly. It's always possible to go too far. But anyway, okay. Let's keep going here. So we've got the margins of the world, Carita. That's as far as we got. Then the enchantment became more and more dreamlike, until he felt that an endless river of swelling gold and silver was flowing over him, too multitudinous for its pattern to be comprehended. It became part of the throbbing air about him, and it drenched and drowned him. Swiftly, he sank under its shining weight into a deep realm of sleep. So, here's my thoughts about this. Again, when we think about the progression, here's how it goes, right? Aesthetic experience. That's very beautiful. The music, the interlocking words. Wow. Great. Then the enchantment, right? Oh, these visions are opening out before my eyes. It's like I can practically see it, right? And then, no, wait, I can actually see it, right? The room has vanished and I'm looking at it. And then something more happens, right? But when he passes above that level, And I'm tempted to say above, because Frodo does seem to be kind of climbing an aesthetic ladder here, right? Not an ascetic ladder, an aesthetic ladder here. He is, after the full fairy and drama experience, right, when he is seeing the stuff around him as with his sensory perception in the primary world, then he's having this other experience, which is more like a dream because he doesn't get it at all, right? An endless river of swelling gold and silver flowing over him, too multitudinous for its pattern to be comprehended, right? Frodo's consciousness has just gone tilt, you know, like a pinball machine, right? He doesn't get this, right? This is washing over him, but it is taking him to a place that he cannot parse with his conscious mind at all, right? Something is happening to him, but he doesn't anymore know what it is. Now he just has vague, sort of weird, confused sensory perceptions that he can kind of link it to. Kind of like being drowned in a river of bright silver and gold, right? Sort of like that. And then more, like it became part of the throbbing air about him. It drenched and drowned him. So he's like, he is soaked in this experience. And then he's drowning in this experience. He can't handle it, right? He has, it's like Frodo does not have the apparatus to receive what is now being transmitted into his directions, right? This is what I mean when I'm talking about the alienness of elvish poetry, right? I mean, the aesthetic experience that he's having, the artistic experience that he is having, is literally exceeding his ability to comprehend it, right? He is still aware of the fact that he is having an artistic experience, right? That he's comparing metaphor, you know, that, he, you know, there's this metaphor still of the river, right? But now that metaphor of the river, which was first an attempt to describe the experience, it now is made sort of more literal, right? The air is throbbing around him and he's drenched and then drowning, all of that water imagery there, right? And then he sinks under its shining weight into a deep realm of sleep. So having been completely overloaded, you know, he's just blown the fuse, right, in his brain, right? Frodo's fuse is blown and he's going into sleep. So, by the way, this is why I think Sam's already asleep. He's already been here. That is to say, to this place where Frodo was. I think that they were not done talking about Shire news before Sam began to pay attention to the music around him, and he's already gone before Frodo down this road here. I'm trying to think of other places where Tolkien describes this kind of thing outside the Notion Club papers. Sorry to keep bringing that up. It's on my mind because I've been doing that for the last couple weeks on Wednesday nights, or last couple months on Wednesday nights. There are some things that are described there that are kind of like this. That is the perception. Like, so for instance, one of the things that Tolkien describes in the Notion Club papers is the experience of having a dream in which you directly experience weight itself, like mass, without sense perception. Like, the only thing that you perceive is, like, weight. And it's, like, pretty trippy. Like, and it's really hard to translate that into language that makes sense and that we can talk about, right? Again, when you read on fairy stories, the implication seems to be that fairy and drama is like the highest level of artistic accomplishment. And in a sense, of course, you could say that at least from Frodo's perspective, the final stages of this, after he gets past the golden mist above seas of foam that side upon the margins of the world, once he passes the margins of the world, which of course is an interesting element in itself, right? Once he passes the margins of the world, it fails for him, right? He is no longer receiving, as I say, the transmission anymore. It's not to say that the art is failing in the sense that the elves are now officially doing a bad job, but it is no longer attuned to Frodo's wavelength. You know what this also reminds me of, and this may not help many of you, but if you know C.S. Lewis's Perelandra, think of the scene at the end of Perelandra when Malacandra and Perelandra, the two Eldila, are appearing to Ransom, and they are asking him, what is a suitable appearance for us to appear before the king and queen of Venus? And they try different appearances, right? Some of which are, like, confusing, some of which, like, damage Ransom, and he's like, God, no, it will drive me insane. And basically, they're trying to hit the right wavelength, right? You know, they're like, how can we attune ourselves so that you can receive what, you know, we're transmitting? And to some extent, I think that this, that's like what's happening here. Again, I don't think that Frodo has the mental or perhaps artistic apparatus to receive this. It's possible, Belongspawn, that the more times he's spent listening, the clearer it becomes. If he stayed at Rivendell for, I don't know, another 17 years, maybe he would. You know, does Bilbo have the same experience in the Hall of Fire? I think he does. I think he does, Bilbo. I don't think Bilbo's gotten used to it yet. I think it probably takes more than that. Because remember, Bilbo is going to sympathize with Frodo and say, it's difficult to stay awake here, right? And I think that that's a testimony, not to Bilbo's narcolepsy, but to this, back to this experience. And Rinros, sure, I've been saying artistic. I definitely don't think it's intellectual. Rinros is saying, could it be a spiritual apparatus? Like, you know, when I talk about what apparatus is it that Frodo is lacking here, right? That is for him not to receive this particular creative transmission or artistic transmission. Spiritual, I think, maybe works. I don't know. I have to admit, to some extent, I am almost as leery of the word spiritual as Tolkien was of the word magic. Not quite. I'm not quite as shy about it, but again, I'm not sure that that's quite the right word under the circumstances, but maybe something like that. Well, Flammifer, maybe. Let's see. So Flammifer is offering an alternative reading, which it's not that he's unable to fully receive it, but that he loses himself. So he's thinking of this in more of like a, through a sort of a Buddhist lens, right? Just as in Buddhist meditation, one loses the self and sort of joins the universe and has one's consciousness opened to that. Is that what's happening to Frodo here? That is possible. There are two things that, there are two things that lead me to suspect that that's not what's happening here. One is... Okay, hang on, let me make sure I'm saying this carefully. One is that the cues that we're given, the descriptors that we're given, are negative, not positive. Let me not say the words negative and positive in a Buddhist context. They are like bad things, not good things, right? It suggests to me not that this is some kind of constructive or good spiritual progress, but rather something is going awry here. First it says it became more and more dreamlike, which is potentially kind of neutral, right? That doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bad thing, but what it does mean is it's becoming more and more disjointed, more and more separate from... First, it was like a perception of a reality that was strange to him, a reality that was fantastical to him, but still a recognizable reality. Now it's starting to leave that reality behind, right? But then this river, which again, it could, I mean, I can see what you're saying, that it could be like that, you know, I am now one with the flow, the gold and silver river, right? It's a spiritual river. And yes, I see the jokes that you guys are making about spiritual boulders. It's a spiritual river, right? So I can totally see that argument, Flammifer, but notice then it drowns him, right? It drenches him and drowns him. You can conceivably see that as like an extinction of self, but again, I don't see that. The throbbing of the air around him, then drenching, then drowning, and then sinking under its shining weight into a deep realm of sleep. This seems to, and it's literally a downward progression, but it seems to me, again, this like things are falling apart. Things are kind of getting worse and worse for him. Not, I think, more and more clear, more and more free. And I mean, I get it. Again, I see about achieving nirvana, leaving reality behind. I see that, but again, that doesn't seem to be the that's not the direction that the narrator's language seems to be pushing us. Right? Again. Dream to throbbing, you know, dream to some kind of suffering, low grade suffering, right? The throbbing of the air around him, the drenching, the drowning, and the sinking. He's being overwhelmed. He's going under here. That's the imagery. That's the metaphor. The metaphor is of a drowning person, not of someone who is coming out of themselves here. Did I say I had two reasons? That was one. I wonder what the other one was. Let me see if I can recapture it. It wasn't something as simple as I don't see Tolkien doing a Buddhist thing. That's not what the other one was. It was, the sinking imagery. Lost it. Sorry. Don't remember the second thing. The final endpoint is oblivion on Frodo's part here. Now, Ray Burns is asking, is Olmo a part of this? You know, I was... thinking about Olmo here for a couple reasons. First, Frodo's having a dreamlike experience, right? And we've seen the sea involved with that before. And of course, the sea sighing on the margins of the world was just happening there too. And then we get this river associated, you know, river and dreams, both of which are associated with Olmo. So there were some like incidental things that were making me think of Olmo here too. I can't think that there's anything directly connected there because again, this is the Elvish, this comes from the Elvish song around him. This is his response to the songs and the poetry that he's hearing, rather than you know, any kind of intervention from the Valar from beyond. Does that prove that it's not? No, not necessarily at all. But yeah, JJ says maybe the elves and Olmo are on a party line. I would also say just because this is not, you know, just because this is coming through the poetry of the elves doesn't necessarily mean that Olmo isn't taking a hand in it any more than when something is happening through the actions of the Valar, that doesn't mean Iluvatar isn't involved. You know, I mean, the boundaries there are often kind of uncertain and unclear. Anyway, so when he's asleep, he then wanders long in a dream of music that turned into running water. Hey, there we go. I'm thinking about the running water again there with Olmo. And then suddenly into a voice. It seemed to be the voice of Bilbo chanting verses. Faint at first, and then clearer, ran the words. Bilbo's song sort of emerges out of his dreams, out of his now unconscious experience. He now goes into not something, he's not just having an experience which is like a dream. He is now having an experience that is a dream, right? Out of that comes the voice of Bilbo chanting verses. I also can't help but notice that it's Bilbo's song that, in a sense, brings him back out of this. If we can sort of map this, right, as Bilbo starting, you know, yeah, no, I think I do want to map it this way. Bilbo starting over here, right, and having a, you know, sort of plunging down into this artistic experience until he sinks to the bottom and he's asleep and actually dreaming, though still probably experiencing the elvish poetry around him. I don't think, by the way, that just because he's in a deep realm of sleep doesn't necessarily mean that he's no longer being influenced by the singing. Again, it's all in the Notion Club papers, right? That's easy to happen. Because he's having dreams, and his dreams are very likely connected to and tied with the songs that are happening around him right now. But then he emerges up out of this again. Like, he is brought back up through this water-like experience, and he reemerges out into the primary world as Bilbo was chanting, right, as he's hearing that. Again, that seems to me a very interesting thing, that there's, it's almost as if, I don't want to say that Bilbo's poetry is an antidote to what's happening to him, because that makes the elvish poetry sound like a poison, which I don't think is really true. But Belongsbond, it does, in a sense, reverse the experience. It brings him back. It gives him something to attach to. In a sense, again, it seems. It is a tie back to the mortal world. That at least seems to be, or almost a way that it, it's like a path that he follows back, a mooring point, says Boomful. Almost like a, again, I'm imagining it as like a, like someone's thrown him a rope, right? And he's being brought back up to the surface or hauled out of the water. Out of the, you know, the river of the swelling gold and silver river. Exactly. That actually, that's really interesting, Winroos. Torimarthen is saying, I wonder if large quantities of hobbit poetry would throw an elf out of whack. And Rinrus responded that elves exist in both worlds simultaneously. Hobbits only exist in one. I think the elves would be fine. Yeah, except they don't necessarily exist in exactly the same world, or at least they don't look at it in the same way. So I think they'll survive it. I don't think it affects them. I don't think that the elves are having any kind of weird out-of-body experiences while they're listening to Bilbo. I suspect they're just more a little bit sort of puzzled by him. Yeah, yeah. So I think I am not going to start the poem tonight. We shall save the lifeline for next week. I said there's a chance we could do the first stanza, but that would be foolish. Even I am too wise to think that at this time of night, when we're already going on 2 hours of discussion here, that it would be a good idea to just do a stanza of poetry too. So let's not do that. So let's leave it here, and we'll pick up with the poem next time. We will see how much of the it's true. We might blow a fuse, Tora Marthen, and I'm sure a bunch of you are on the verge of sinking under the shining weight of our discussion into a deep realm of sleep anyway, just because of the time of day. Let's pause. And we'll leave Frodo in his dream state, and we shall re-emerge there with him next week as we begin Bilbo's great poem, my second favorite poem of Tolkien's. We will do that. We will do that next week. Thanks, everybody, for joining me. I'm going to say goodbye to the folks on Twitter. We're going to switch over to twitch.tv/signumu for our field trip. And everybody is welcome to join us there for our Lord of the Rings online field trip. So thank you, Twitter folks. Okay.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening. All right. Okay.
All right. So we're looking at Gondomin today, right?
Gondomin, yes. We had gotten up to the edge of Gondomin and then stopped on the doorstep. And in particular, we were told that... let's talk about that as we go. All right. Off we go.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we can't. We still can't do a direct horse anywhere closer, can we? Than Cuondon?
No.
Yeah.
Or Thorns. It's equidistant between Dweland and Thorns Hall. So.
Yeah. Well, we might as well ride through the terrain we have covered. So.
Just to backtrack at any rate. I love all these passages that Tolkien does about music and song. It always reminds me so much of the passages like in the Kalevala where they're getting the sun back from Pokiola having the army of men with Kantele's kind of harp.
Right. Yep. Absolutely.
And just how that's their magic in that world. All sorcery was knowing songs. So I love these hints and nods to it. But also just how Tolkien viewed music in the first place. It was a divine gift from Eru. So any moment where you're being swept away from music is your connection to the divine in this world.
Yes, yes. Yeah, no, I mean, that's, you know, from the Ainulin away on, that kind of thing is definitely at play. And you're certainly right about the Kalevala influence. I mean, that's... I think it's when Tolkien talked about the Kalevala, you know, and he usually talked about the language. You know, Tolkien was, you know, such a language geek that he was always like, Finnish. Oh, Finnish is so great. I just loved Finnish. And it's not that I'm doubting him. Like, I'm not questioning that that's true and that he really, you know, the Finnish language really did speak to him, you know, in this very important way and everything. All that stuff is perfectly true. But because he spent so much time talking about the language, you know, he didn't talk nearly as much about what he, like the other ways, the more narrative ways in which the and sort of mythological ways in which the Kalevala influenced him, but that is clearly one. I think the Kalevala is probably the best way to begin to understand the link between music and magic in Tolkien's world. It's the thing that's most similar. It's not exactly the same. I mean, I don't really believe that. you know, it's like, it's just the, you know, it's the same.
It's barely mythology. It's like a microcosm of mythology, where instead of 800 tricksters, we just got the one, and we got the one wizard and the one hero, and the right. one brash guy gets into trouble, and that's it. That's all we can afford. We have to huddle around these archetypes for warmth. So.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of really interesting stuff there. I'm very much an amateur at the Kalevala. I've only read it a few times. I'm not.
You kidding? My favorite thing is the day the Earth froze in the MST3K version.
Oh my goodness! There was one point at which I paused when we were watching that MST3K with my kids, where I sort of paused it. And I'm like, okay, let me explain about the Sampo. I'm like, no, never mind. Like, I'm like, it's because
it's a strapless evening gown.
Well, I was wondering whether it was, like, in my opinion, it was the funniest moment in the original film, not in the MST3K riffs on it, but in the actual film when. They were like, but what is a Sampo? And I'm like, okay, that's kind of an inside joke, because, like, the fact is nobody actually does know what a Sampo was, in fact.
You know, a Sampo.
Yeah, exactly. That was very good. Needless to say, I had never seen that film before, the MST3K. It was not something I knew of.
Yeah.
And I was very surprised. I'm like, I can't believe that this is just a straight up Kalevala film. Weird though it was. I'm like, I can't believe I'm watching a film version of the making of the Sampo right now.
Swedish version of the Finnish tale.
Yeah, exactly. Swedish version of the Finnish tale being made fun of by MST3K. So that was a really fun experience. Okay. So Gondamin is now coming into view in the distance. Now, the thing we were discussing at the very end last time that we were wanting to explore this time is that the deed quest insists that, the deed text, I should say, insists that Gondamin was an elvish fortress taken over by the dwarves. Now, this matches what we were noticing about the architecture, that is the actual stone, right, of which the building materials, right, that that vertical blue vein and that, you know, brownish gray stone, you know, we saw that down in Kelladul. That's the stone that marks the archaeological era of Thorin's people, right, in the last couple hundred years. So this is obviously a dwarvish place, except we were told that it's not. That it's in fact an elvish place. From a distance, we can't see a lick of evidence of that. Like, I see no even memory of elvish architecture necessarily. That is, you know, like no actual remnant.
Pull the other one.
Yeah, exactly. The spires on the top, like the very topmost spire, I like to try to convince myself that that looks a little bit like the top of the towers. You know, like near the vineyard and stuff, but it doesn't really. It looks like a dwarvish marker. It's like itself. Exactly. Yeah. So
when they say they renovated it, we can just assume they meant raised to the ground.
Raised to the ground and built entirely anew. Yeah. Because you can really see, I mean, all the way down, this is not even built on other foundations or anything like that. I mean, it's,
nope. No, like right, yeah, even right down to the rock sticking out of the rock over here, we still got the Celtic knotwork foundation.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, down to the paving stones, which we've seen have been dwarvish throughout. Though, as we said, it seems likely that Thorin's people had been involved in that before. Now, Matt was asking, and I think it's an interesting question, what about these bridges? Like, again, obviously, dwarvish construction. We see that dwarvish knotwork along the side. The, you know, the very geometric shapes here the sort of the triangle and diamond shapes and the squares, all very sort of dwarvish and what we would expect. But just like the concept, you know, that he's, oh yeah, Taweth, yes. Arkenstone, yes. We're just arriving here. We're on Arkenstone and we're here in Gondomon.
Yes.
So Matt's...
You mean these walkways? Or the
walkways. The walkways without railings. You know,
well,
he was saying...
Yeah, I was going to say without railings was a clue that it might be off.
Yeah, the thing, because, you know, this is a very marked feature of Gondomon, right? We get all this, no walls up here on the top, you know, no battlements up here around the top. And we get, again, all these open walkways, which are very airy and don't necessarily seem... seem very dwarvish necessarily.
Except it looks just like the harbor.
It does. And also we did see walkways like this, like in the north, and I'm always forgetting the names. That dwarvish city in the northern part of the North Downs.
Othrakar,
yeah. Now, they weren't this high up off the ground, but we did get these kinds of overpasses there.
Yeah, that's the weird part. This does not seem as dug into rock as the other ones, other dwarven structures have. They're either nestled in a valley, or they're up against a cliff face, or they're into the mountain itself or something like that. Well, this... this structure itself is just on a hill, which doesn't seem very dwarvish.
Right. I mean, very natural in one sense, in that, like, it's a pretty good idea to... it's a very defensible position from a non-underground people perspective, right? I mean, that's not how dwarves normally think about defending themselves. They don't normally think of castles on hills. They normally think of, you know, underground things.
Yeah, they're like the kid who pushes their bed against the wall so nothing can creep up from behind.
Something like that, yeah. So in that sense, perhaps, you know, that there's this sort of very indirect thing, right? So there was an elvish city here. It fell into ruin. Now, as Deathman is quoting for me the text again. And it does emphasize in the text, the dwarves later rebuilt the stronghold to their liking, right? So it does... clearly emphasized that their renovation was rather thoroughgoing. Right, exactly. They didn't like any of it. Yeah. And also that it had fallen into ruin. So it's not like it was a perfectly functional fortress that they were like, oh no, we can do better than that. It had been ruined, and they just scrapped it and started again from scratch. But again, the fact that they started again from scratch here is still suggestive. That is still perhaps in that sense inspired by the elvish fortress, in that, like, you know, there was a fortress here, and so they're like, okay, this is a pretty good place for us to build a fortress. And so they built
now,
it here.
Now have we seen the red pillars before? Usually the ones we've seen are green. These look more like jasper or something.
Yes, we have seen green ones. Can somebody remind me, did we see red ones in Caledula? I can't remember.
I thought there were only green ones, but I'm not positive.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the green ones, definitely.
Yeah, this is definitely some kind of red quartz.
I really like the little obelisks on top of everything. It's cute.
Yeah. It's like toothpicks in a sandwich.
Yeah, like on top of everything. Like, no battlements, but...
There's a statue up at the very top there. Right before the tallest spire.
Oh, yeah. I think it's one of those axe statues. Yeah, like this guy?
It's like that guy... yeah, I think it's bigger, though, given the scale.
Yeah, probably. And these are the same guys at Caledul with the fully realized axe. And here you can see it even more clearly, which is really fun, right? The actual dwarf figure is extremely bland, right? The only look at the only things that stand out here. You've got the axe. You've got his mail shirt underneath, like that, what looks like his tie, right?
Uh-huh.
You've got his crown. And then you've got, you can see his, he's got like bracelets on his wrists peeking out, right?
Yeah, his wristers.
Yeah. But so only the metalwork, which seems to be made with real metalwork, right?
Yeah.
And that's in really careful detail, but the face is just kind of scratched on. The interesting thing to me is that he does seem to be wearing armor, but that's not realized. I mean, those look like, that looks like, you know, plate armor on his shoulders, but we're not interested in that. We're only interested in like his under, you know, corselet or whatever, and his axe. And his bracelets or bracers, and his
well, that's what the fancy
helm.
Work would be.
Yeah,
where you show off your artistry.
I guess so.
Waste it on.
Yeah, on your shoulders.
Maybe. Or maybe they just got weathered a bit.
Right, but and then
yeah,
his
rest
feet.
Of the face is pretty. It's stylized.
It's stylized, right? Exactly. It's this big old mustache, and then a sort of a beard, and.
Like a chainsaw carving.
Yes, it does look like a chainsaw carving, actually. Yeah. And then look at his feet. It's just like, okay, vague robe, and there's a little gesture towards feet peeking out the front, right?
That's what artists do when they don't want to draw feet.
Just two little bumps sticking out at the bottom.
Yeah, it's like putting hands in pockets. It's a classic trick.
Right. Right, because hands are
so,
hard, yeah.
It shows you their priorities, but it just shows you their priorities.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, no, I think this is just a really fun testimony. Oh, look, and he's got a belt buckle, too.
Oh, yeah. Priorities, once again.
Yeah, he's got a belt buckle, too.
Well, and, you know, look down there. There's still a thriving market now.
Yep.
So, you know, having statues like this is almost a form of advertising, especially if you're the smith who made it.
Yeah, but no, I mean, this is clearly how they think, right? How they prioritize. I love this touch. I think that's really great. Ooh, banner. Sorry, I've been staring at the statue and I didn't even notice the banner behind it.
Oh, yeah.
That's really interesting. And yet... Catriona, you're right. He does look like he's wearing mittens. You know, his hands are very vague. But yeah, looking at the banner. Okay. So we have...
Longbeard.
Three diamond shapes. And then we have that thing in the gold thing, which is a hammer? I think? It's hammer-ish?
I thought it was a face with a long beard.
Maybe at the bottom, you mean?
No, at the top, the gold thing.
No, I mean at the bottom of the thing at the top. The bottom of the
bottom of the
gold
thing at the top. Well, it might help if I up my graph.
So there's the gold thing, which looks like a letter T. Vaguely T-shaped. It's got a sort of a pointed and cross piece at the top, and then the sort of shaft down at the bottom.
Oh, yes, now I see it.
Yeah.
It's a warhammer.
I took that for a warhammer, but it's an awfully strange haft, if that's it. Because, I mean, like, there's no place to actually hold it. It's, like, if that were an actual hammer, it would be so, the haft would be so fat you couldn't even hold it.
Ceremonial.
Yeah. Or also, I wonder if that's not a hammer at all. Maybe that's a... It almost looks like something that could be like a medal that you pin to your chest. Like the thing at the top and then a dangly underneath it, you know?
Like on the top of Roman centurion banners, right?
Oh, you mean a signum? Yes. It could potentially be like that.
Signum. And I messed that one up.
Yes. I'm familiar with that. Yes.
I don't know. It might just be pareidolia, but I still think I see a face in that.
Well, I see what you're seeing there. Again, in the bottom part of it, right? The eyes and the long pointed beard at the bottom?
No, at the very, very top, those two indentations near the top look like eyes and then a nose and then a very long golden beard with ornaments in it.
Very top. I don't know. I'm not seeing it. I don't know if maybe my graphics are higher than yours.
It could be. Or once again, maybe we're just seeing what we see in
looking shapes. It's like a golden cloud shape here, you know. Yeah,
exactly.
The dwarfish Rorschach test. Yeah. Ooh, hang on. I can see it below us too. I'm trying to see if I can get a little closer.
Druid's Fire brought up something interesting. The lamps up here are blue and the ones down in the marketplace are red.
Dude, I didn't even register that there were lamps, full stop. Okay, hang on. So this is
right in front of us.
Well, yeah, but just because it's right in front of me doesn't mean I noticed it. Okay, so let's see.
Definitely some sort of phosphorescent blue.
Yeah. Is that a crystal?
Yep.
Okay. So it's a luminescent.
Nice touch, very mythic.
Crystal, yes. Very mythic.
But the ones on the ground floor down there are red. The ones by the market.
I'll have to go down and look at those. But, of course, blue fire, blue lamps, of course, make one think
blue
of
veins.
Of the Feanorian lamps. And one wonders if these weren't sort of inspired by that. Now, presumably this is just crystal that was discovered. Do you think it was made? Maybe it was made?
Yeah, some kind of crystal lamp, maybe. I thought it was to complement the blue veined stone that they used to decorate.
Well, it certainly does complement it nicely. I can't believe
the red ones complement the jasper.
Maybe. Can't believe I haven't Rivendell'd any of these bridges yet. I'm trying to see if
I can't remember.
If there's a... Oops, I've lost my cursor. I hate it when that happens. Oh, there it is. Okay.
No.
I'm trying to see if I can get any closer to... Even closer to one of these banners. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, here we go.
Yeah. Tharvadir was just noticing this over here, too. Yep. All right, well, we can't do much better than that, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, we're actually on top of the awning. That's fun. okay, yep. Yep, spiritual cushions is reminding us of the light of sun and star and moon and shining lamps of crystal hewn, undimmed by cloud or shade of night. They're shown forever fair and bright. Yes.
Yep.
Yes. Exactly. And that does seem to be what we're seeing over here. Not here. This is the banner.
Mm-hmm.
Noxie Key, you think it's a crown? Maybe.
Weird kind of crown. Like going to your spinal cord or something? Maybe. it still looks like a signum to me. I can't unsee a signum.
Bright, quite possibly. As is common in a lot of the... Yeah, they do look a little bit like gears, Catron, I agree. Like a lot of dwarvish art, there seems to be just sort of a lot of like not work in geometry here. Those round things that look like gears, Catron, I suspect of being non-representative, like they're not meant to actually be representative art as much as just kind of geometric conceptual, though they do look wheel-like, certainly, like coins. Are they meant to evoke wheels and coins and gears, all three of which things would be valuable, valuable parts of dwarvish culture and trade and industry?
Wealth and merchant. Maybe it's a symbol that this is a market.
Right.
This is a place where coins are traded for goods. Look at the texture on the cloth as well. It's made to look like it's a cut piece of marble or something.
Yes, yes. Yes, that's true. Yeah, at first I thought it was actually just how it was hanging, but no, I agree. It does look like it is representing something, maybe not exactly marble, but something kind of like that.
Well, it looks like a design you could make with, like, marble tiles and gold inlay.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe
so. You wonder if it was that first and then the tapestries came later to mimic that?
Yeah. Oh, you know, Deathman, thank you for that. I was wondering, and we'll look at this a little bit more later, whether or not this was a Gondaman-specific symbol or whether this was... I don't know why I'm still on my horse. That's one of my big questions here. Whether this was a sort of a broader symbol, you know, something that we saw, you know, is this a Thorin's banner or is this a Gondaman banner in particular? So he says it's a Thorin's banner. We will see it in Thorin's Gate.
Interesting. I'd love to see the context used.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I totally was standing on top of an awning while on a horse like a boss. I was rocking that. Okay, so now here we have some real fire, but of course that's a milestone lamp, which is in a sort of a different category. And, here are the red ones. Aha! Uh-huh.
Rock, yes. Sand, you don't have to wear that.
Okay. You don't have to put on the red light? Is that what you're suggesting? Yes. Sorry, I'm backing up to where I can see them both. Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
And yes, definitely. I agree with you that the red is clearly designed to complement the red quartz or whatever it is that makes the little red obelisks, while the blue highlights the blue in the those vertical lines all the way through. Yeah, that's lovely. Okay, now look at this.
Ground floors, forges, workshops.
Look at this. Look at this dude down here. So this contrasting to all of those semi-generic metal crafting statues, here we get a totally different dwarvish statue. He's got fingers, A, right?
Sort of.
B, he's got, I know, fingers-ish. More fingers than the other guy had. He was just wearing mittens. He's got knees and legs and elbows. And
he's contrapposto.
And a real beard. He looks like he's about ready to start his aria. He's got none of that metal work on, right? Nothing, none of that, like, things that stands out. He's got a nose.
Yep.
But he
has... So, as I mentioned... The stance he's in, contrapposto, this was pioneered by the ancient Greeks, and it was a much more difficult pose to do. It requires a lot of finesse to get that balance exactly right and to make it look like the weight is distributed on both feet without it falling over and metal posts going up through. That's what the Romans did when the art was lost. They'd put metal posts up or they'd make them leaning on rocks or and logs and stuff because they couldn't figure it out. So this implies that their art style and ability has evolved a lot since the other statues. Made by someone more highly skilled.
Right, since the chainsaw statues that we were looking at before. With the really, really impressive metalwork, right? Because, again, that's clearly the sculptor who sculpted the dwarf who's holding the axe and wearing the crown and the corslet and the braces is barely trying, right? Because he's totally uninterested in the actual figure. He's only interested in the figure as a mannequin, right, to support the metalwork, which is clearly the point. This is a totally different guy. He's got no metalwork, but not only that, he's got nothing. I mean, like, I'm kind of surprised.
No sword, no shield, no axe, no nothing.
No, I mean, have we seen a bare-handed statue anywhere?
No, but there is a broken shield here on this table over here. This is the Scholar's Enclave.
Whoa. That can't be his shield.
Maybe.
Besides which, I don't believe he's wearing a shield. What's he doing with his thumb and forefinger? Could he be holding something in his right hand, or have been holding something that's been lost?
Could be. The fact that this is the Scholar's Enclave sort of indicates that they're studying it too.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe this is like a Moria art style that got lost along with Moria itself.
Right. Yeah, I'm trying.
These weapons were made out, had like wooden hafts or something, and they rotted away over the.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, and Katrina, I agree. I do think that the sculptor of the other statues, the one we were looking at up there, was not incompetent, just uninterested. It's a deliberate choice to keep the details of the figure sketchy, because you're obviously supposed to be looking at the axe first and foremost. But this is so far in the opposite direction. Not only, you know, as you're saying, a much more dynamic figure and a much more interesting figure to look at, but he's got nothing. He's got a crown, but that's all he's got. He's holding nothing.
The dwarven equivalent of David confronting Goliath and nothing,
right.
You know, he's got
right.
No weapons.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we gotta look to see if this guy or this sculptor.
Gesture.
Yeah, maybe it is. I am going to be very interested to see if we see any other statues like that around Thorin's area.
Thorin's Hall. Yeah.
Yeah. See what other kind of art that we get here.
Oh, I love the geometric style and the columns here and then the brazier.
Yes, I mean, just as you get lots of intricate, you know, vines and flowers and things in Elvish architecture, mm-hmm. you get these really interesting and ornate, you know, line and geometric shapes in dwarf architecture.
Deco, very art deco.
Yeah. And yet, no, I am not seeing one scrap of actual leftover elf ruin anywhere.
Yeah.
You would never know
like
that there was an
the
elf.
Rubble.
No rubble, no. Nothing. Nothing at all. Down to the cobblestones, nothing. All. This is 100% dwarf all the time. So they certainly did
so
make it over to their liking.
I know you can actually get pretty high. Yeah, I know you can actually get up pretty high in this structure, by the way. I forget just how many floors you can go up on this.
Yes. Yeah, you can see that guy patrolling up there way up in towards the sky. He just went behind the tower from where we're standing. But just as you said that, I looked up at the tall tower, and you could see this dwarf walking around the top walk up there. Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, it is after midnight. So after a fun and thorough examination of Gondamin, which has long since forgotten its elvish roots, perhaps the stones still remember the elves, if you could talk to them about it. In fact, that would be interesting. I wonder what the stone, we know what the stones in Eregion say about the elves who once lived there. I wonder what the stones around here say. And what they have to say about the dwarves, their current occupants, and if they like the, if they think it's an upgrade or not. It would be particularly interesting to talk to the stones here. Yeah. But anyway, okay. Let's leave it here. We will continue on past. So we've passed sort of the middle range here. Let's go up in the northern. Along the northern banks to that. Yeah, we need to go to that dwarvish city that we saw up due north here, across the road and up against the mountains up there, which we saw from a distance, but then we thought we'd come up from Gondamin. So we will continue to move over into the dwarf area, and we'll begin to see, having established the characteristics of what seem to be typical dwarvish architecture here, if we can see how we can see that developing, and what patterns, larger patterns, we can begin to observe as we go all the way through. So anyway, thanks very much, everybody, for joining me tonight, and I will see you guys again next week when the fundraising campaign will have started. So that'll be fun.
Woo-hoo!
All right. Thanks, everybody. Good night now.
All right. Good night.
Thanks for joining me on this epic exploration of The Lord of the Rings and of Standing Stone's video adaptation of Tolkien's story. If you are having even half the fun I'm having on this journey, I hope you will consider supporting the project by donating at signumuniversity.org/fund.